Well, we're way, do we have anyone signed up on 3355? Is that a sponsoring bill of the Stevens Estates? It's one of the members' bills, I think. While we're waiting for Hetty, let's go ahead into a work session on House Bill 2357 and 2436. We have some amendments which I have given people an opportunity to come and talk about. I'm not sure how I feel about them when I read them over, but I have told people that they could have, you know, a few minutes to discuss them since they said they didn't have it together on the House side. So let's go into these as a work session. And Representative Maddox, you want to come forward, and Carly Davis and Jim Trappi here.
And I'll pass out the amendments, Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Maddox.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Maddox, State Representative for District 32, which is Central and Northeast Salem. I'm aware of the what I'll call the Davis amendments, which propose that the temporary release bill and the parole bill be modified so that you simply prohibit a person from returning to the county of incarceration. I've discussed this with Elise Clausen from the Department of Corrections, and as the proponent of the bill and in having worked with corrections on this, their position is the same. We would oppose those amendments. The original bill was actually a Marion County bill in the sense that we just wanted to move people out of Marion County, but the bill was reworked so that it was a good parole bill, a good temporary release bill, a bill that the Board of Parole and the Department of Corrections felt would lead to some planning as to where inmates would go after their release. And these amendments would just, in effect, gut this bill and put us back to a self-serving Marion County bill, and that was not the deal that I made with the representatives from around the state who supported this bill. And so I have to honestly tell you that I'm not here just to help Marion County. I think that we need a balanced correction system, and I'm opposed to those amendments. Senator Shoemaker has put together some very good amendments, I think, to clarify some of the language, and I have absolutely no problem with those. Thank you.
Thank you. And, let's hear from Jack. The Senator Shoemaker amendments are the A4 amendments?
Those are the A4, and there is also the -5 amendments, Madam Chair.
Which are?
The A4 amendment, if you recall, was the substitution of the word may for shall on page 2, line 10 of the bill, so that the State Board of Parole has the option of waiving the residency requirement rather than the language being mandatory. The A5 amendments, there was a request, I believe, from Representative Maddox to have the language in 2436 more to track the language in the other bill.
So that's what this is, and the A5 amendments meet with your approval.
Yes.
Thank you. So we just
Thank
want
you.
To make a double check on
Madam Chair,
Senator Shoemaker.
In addition to the May, from shall to may, I also thought it would be well to delete the requirement that the inmate provide proof of a full-time job before he could be considered. That proof of a job ought to be sufficient.
And I had no objection to
okay,
that.
Okay, so that's one that Jack okay. probably missed.
And that would be in line 12 of 2436 and line 27 on page 1 of 2357.
Let's deal with the 2436
yeah,
first.
Okay.
And let's hold that one for a minute till we hear from the other folks. We can
yeah.
make
yeah.
sure that Jack will note that when we get. Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin. Let's go ahead and hear from Mr. Davis and Mr. Trappi.
Ms. Davis.
Oh, Ms. Davis. Carly. Oh, excuse me.
Carly, like Carly Simon?
Yes.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I can't even read Jack's writing.
Not very often.
It's not Jack, it's me. Thank you.
Well, I'm Carly Davis and Jim Trappi, and I obviously disagree with Representative Maddox, and this is where I'm coming from. Once, quite a while ago, in the Senate gallery, Michael Franke and I talked for an hour or so, and Michael said that it was his perception that there are a percentage of inmates whose personalities are too far damaged to have any programs have much of an impact or conditions when they are released. But he also said there also, he also stated that he felt there were a small, there were a percentage of inmates who would do okay on release. And then he went on to say that there's a percentage of inmates who on release could go either way. And it is those inmates that that population that motivated my family to speak out in regards to this amendment. We feel that the best chance a parolee has on release is when that parolee has the widest choices of where to go. If that parolee has the choice to choose not to go back to a drug confederacy and chooses not to go back to a gang situation and chooses to go to where he may have positive, a core of positive relatives or friends where he may build a new life. Those are not many people, but they are a significant number. It doesn't make sense to look at long-term incarcerated people and talk about where you should return them to when any reason for them returning to those places may have long disappeared. If someone is released after 25 years, what is the point of looking up their driver's license? That's a very long, complicated procedure that you have outlined as far as making sure that the person goes back to wherever they came from. If that person is from a small county in eastern Oregon, jobs may have not be available when they go back to that community. That happens very quickly in small towns. We all know that small towns have, and whole counties, the economy changes within a few years. A mill may close. There may be nothing there. Our friendly amendment, which we offered to deal with the problems which host cities of corrections institutions are legitimately trying to come to terms with. It is not healthy for anyone to have a large population of parolees in a Salem or a possible wherever else there may be other large institutions. But it is also not healthy to send people back to where they came from to almost guarantee that they will become involved in the same kinds of activities that brought them to the incarceration in the first place. Our friendly amendment says that on line 24 of the bill, that the inmate reside for the first 6 months outside the county where the inmate has been most recently incarcerated by the State Department of Corrections. And of course, the rest of the bill would change in turn, and to make the exceptions to that, the people, it would change the wording, and that's been outlined in our letter, and I'm sure that legal counsel could look at that and see if it is properly done. And the exceptions would be then for people who wanted to remain in the county where they were incarcerated. And there are legitimate reasons always to make exceptions to rules. And we strongly recommend the adoption in concept of our friendly amendment because we feel it will benefit all of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman.
Go ahead, Jim.
And members of the committee. I work with a volunteer group in Corvallis, NCOS, which has been formed to help released prisoners reintegrate into society. So I have some personal experience with the kinds of obstacles they face. And those obstacles are partly built into them by the way our correctional system operates. Partly it's society's attitude. These bills, as originally worded, would put one more and sometimes a very significant set of obstacles in front of these people, even if they want to go straight, for the reasons that Carly has mentioned. If we are really serious about reducing crime in Oregon, It can't be by putting more people in prison for longer periods. Study after study after study over the decades has showed that rates of incarceration have practically no bearing on the incidence of crime. If we are really serious about preventing crime, it can't just be sending a message. Because again, study after study after study has shown that threats of punishment and so forth do not prevent crime, simply because most crime, aside from the mafia sort of thing, is done on impulse by people who are acting irrationally, and threats don't affect that. Where we can have the real impact on reducing crime is to do everything we can to see that people who are coming out of our prison system have every possible opportunity to go straight, to get a job, to get the kind of medical and drug treatment they need, to have family or emotional support. For example, there are groups such as ENTOS and church groups that will adopt released prisoners, but by the original wording of this proposed bill, a prisoner might not be able to take advantage of such a group if it happened to be elsewhere than where he was convicted. Again, then, I urge the adoption of this amendment because of its possibility to help rehabilitation and to help guys who and women who are possibly otherwise going to commit new crimes to help them go straight.
Thank you. Senator Grinsky.
Maybe I'm missing something again here. Maybe this is my day to be off, but I don't understand why sending someone back to the county where the crime was committed is necessarily precluding them from getting into the kinds of programs you refer to. I'm not necessarily saying that it will or won't, but I don't make the connection that
It doesn't necessarily preclude them, but it limits the options. There are not all that many drug treatment programs available in Oregon, for example. If somebody was convicted in Harney County and has to go back to Harney County, and most of the people coming out of our correctional system do need substance abuse treatment, that person's going to go back to Harney County and look for a job and not find it, and then what?
Okay, but I think that we need to make clear that the amendments that the House made in this bill would allow for those accommodations, in the sense that if there were no programs available, you would not have to go back to that county.
Only, as it's worded, only if such treatment were required is the word. Presumably a condition imposed by the parole board. But unless the parole board is habitually going to require everybody to do this, and they can't because there aren't that many treatment slots available, a lot of these people who need the treatment might be willing to get it through other means, could be in places where it's not available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Grinsky.
I still have to follow up. I don't see how your amendment, which would require these people to go somewhere other than the county where they were last incarcerated for the first 6 months, I don't see how that necessarily is going to get them into a program anywhere.
Well, it opens up all but one county as optional places for them to go. The way the bill is written now, it closes all the options except one county.
But
well, that assumes that they're going to...
I think there will be some appropriate planning that doesn't necessarily close all of the options. But Senator Shoemaker, and then I think we need to...
Yeah, it seems to me that if you're troubled by the bill as it now stands, and it must be true that the place of residence of a lot of inmates at the time the crime was committed is Marion County. Is that true? Do you have statistics on that?
No, I don't.
Well, then how do you know it's a problem? We are concerned that under the bill as it stands, too many of these prisoners would go to Marion County because that was where they lived when the crime was committed.
Well, but my understanding was one of the intentions of the bill was to reduce the concentration of populations in Marion County. But well, contrary to being a Marion County bill, you know, this would apply to Pendleton, to Coos Bay, to other places where prisons are sited.
Do you have statistics on how many people happen to be incarcerated in the county that they lived when the crime was committed?
No.
But if, without those, unless we know there are a lot of those, and why are we bothering, why isn't the bill adequate the way it is? It says that you have to go back to where you came from unless you make a showing to the State Board of Parole that another place is more appropriate because of a treatment program or because of the presence of family or for some other good reason. What's wrong with that?
Well, for one thing, we've followed many cases through the parole situation. In every case that I have followed, the person has had substance and alcohol problems.
Yeah, but you deal with that in either bill.
No, well, I'm saying that in these cases that I've been in the last couple of years, there has been no mention at the parole hearing that that inmate be get alcohol. Oh, in one case there was, but it was just to get outpatient alcohol treatment. And what Senator Cohen was saying, that, well, it's going to be something that the parole board will address, well, it just isn't. It isn't something that they address, and it needs to be addressed. But I heard verbally again and again and again, there are too many inmates being released in at the doorstep of the institutions in Salem. And that I heard verbally from our legislators and from people who are here. And saying we've got to do something about this. Well, I agree. I agree that if they feel it's perceived as a problem, and certainly the legislators from Salem know the situation, and they are the ones who said this, who said again and again when I talked with them that there is a problem in Salem. And my projection is that if they feel there's a problem in Salem where there are two large institutions, that it is probable as that there may be future problems with other institutions in other cities. And it seems to me that any bill that is written should be written so that they are, so that it deals realistically with the counties where, which house correctional institutions. But it also needs to deal realistically with the possibilities for a parolee. And if, as Jim said, that if you limit the possibilities, you are also limit the possibilities of residence, you're also limiting the possibilities for a positive life. And unfortunately,
Let me stop you there, because I don't quite see how the bill as written limits the possibilities. The presumption is that you go back to where you came from unless the parole board finds there's a more appropriate place. Because of and your bill says only that you can't go back to the county where the prison is. It doesn't say where you shall go.
Right. That's
so
correct.
Thus, unless the parole board decides there is a place you should go, you're just released and you can't go to, you have to be somewhere other than Marion County. Where you go is up to you.
All right. No. They also, if you have connections in Marion County or in the county where the corrections institution is located, then the exceptions will allow you to go there, just as the exceptions would allow you to go wherever in the way the bill was originally written.
Actually,
thank
the bill.
You. I really am going to stop this off now because I do not sense that there's support for your amendments. So it doesn't do a long time for us to argue about things that are not. We do appreciate your concerns and your interest and your efforts. I do believe that if you look carefully at the bill and if you work with the parole board or the Department of Corrections in helping them develop their planning, and I would say to you that up until this time, we've never funded any release planning. There is some funding this time for release planning, and I believe that you have a new attitude in the Department of Corrections that understands that with respect to the revocations that go on, that it is in everyone's best interest that you have release planning that is meaningful, including those people who are feeling threatened if they go back to their own county, and some options that will allow them to go to other places. I do believe that there are enough exceptions in this bill, having read thoroughly, as I've talked with you, your amendments and the amendments that we have now as are modified in this bill. So I'm just sharing with you my concern. I think that you'll find if you read the new bill as opposed to the very original bill, there are some times, and I would be interested in your returning if the pre-release planning doesn't work out as advocated here or as we've been led to believe, then we do need to hear from people to say, it isn't working, we've got to find another way. But, so I guess with that, I'd say, appreciate your time in coming. And we have looked it over, and all of the members on this committee have looked at your proposed amendments. And again, do appreciate your interest in assisting people who are coming out of prison and those who are trying to make changes in their lives.
Well, thank you for giving us a hearing.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else want to comment? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, then I would move the House Bill 2346-A4 amendments.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved House Bill 2436, the A4 amendments, including the line 12 change, which would delete full-time.
Correct. Proof of a job, then?
Yes, it would be a job. And then would you like to add on the A5 amendments as well?
If you want to do them together.
Yeah, I think we could do them
together. Madam Chair, then I would also...
Wait, Jack?
And there is one additional amendment that I think the committee had discussed, and that's on page 2, line 17, including the words "or adoptive." So it would read biological family or adoptive family residing. That is in the other bill. That's the companion of this one.
I move that also.
Okay. Senator Hill is moving that language on line...
Line 17.
Line 17 as well. Are there objections to Senator Hill's amendments?
No objection, but I'm just looking at 2357, and I noted another suggestion that I had that I think is appropriate here, too. And that is to add to the list of reasons why the Board of Parole could allow the parolee to go to some other place,
okay,
kind of a catch-all for other good cause shown, so that we don't assume we've thought of everything. Maybe that's one that needs discussion, so why don't I move that after these amendments
are
adopted.
I'd like to move Senator Hill's amendments. And are there any objections to Senator Hill's amendments to House Bill 2436? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, with that, if you're going to offer additional language, I'd ask Representative Mannix to come up and see what he says about that one, because it does make it broader.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. I think that if Senator Shoemaker's amendment was a little bit more carefully defined, for example, for other good cause shown of a nature similar to the other exceptions specified within the Act, and in other words, require that they specify what is their good cause and not just say for a good cause we have made this determination, but they would specify the good cause and it would be of a nature similar to the other exceptions. In case we have overlooked something, they can point it out and say, well, we're in phase with the types of exceptions already put in the Act.
Yeah, sounds reasonable.
Jack, you have gotten those words out. I guess the chair would accept an amendment to adopt that, and as Representative Mannix has stated, conceptually, and he stated it pretty clearly on the record, Senator Shoemaker.
That's fine.
Are there objections to making that.
That
additional amendment that Senator Shoemaker has moved? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2436 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Hill has moved House Bill 2436 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Grinsky.
Real briefly, this is a real difficult bill for me to decide on. The thing that concerns me the most about it is the very things that would keep someone from going back into a life of crime are the things that have to be missing in order for that person to be sent back to where they last committed the crime. In other words, there's no family there, they don't have a job and all those things. That means they go back to the last place they committed a crime. We know 80% of crime is drug-related, which means that a lot of those people are still going to be around. We may almost be forcing these people back into a life of crime. That's what concerns me. However, we have the reality that a lot of these people are committing crimes, and it isn't fair for one county to bear all that burden. reason I'm saying this is this. The next session, and I will be back because I'm not running again for a while. If this isn't working and all these people are doing is going around to these states committing more crimes, one of my top priorities is going to be to repeal this bill if it doesn't work. But I hope that there will be some real emphasis placed on rehabilitating people, because that's really where the action is, not just redistributing the new crimes that they're going to commit. And so if this thing is just doing that, then I'm going to be moving to repeal it next time, and that's, and I'll be armed with statistics, hopefully, to show that. I hope it doesn't happen, but if that is what happens, then we're going to have to do something about that.
Further comments? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Mr. Bilbe.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Rensky.
Aye.
Hill.
Aye.
Shoemaker.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Let's move to House Bill 2357, which is companion.
Madam Chair, that is the companion bill. There is an A6 amendment, which again, on page 1, line 25, changes the word shall to may.
And we need those other amendments as well.
And we would need the amendment proposed by Senator Shoemaker.
Would it be appropriate to simply move amendments to 2357 that are in every respect consistent with those moved in 2436?
The Senator, the adoptive language is already in there.
Oh, and the A5 is already.
And the A5 are repetitive.
Okay.
Yes. We need the shall to may, the adopt, or excuse me, the adopt.
Delete the full time.
Yes.
And add the catch-all other good cause in the
yes.
way that. Okay, I'll move those amendments. Okay.
Senator Shoemaker is moving those amendments that Jack's recited to change the.
Yes.
Shall to may, and the full-time removal of the words full-time, and the catch-all language that we've previously adopted as defined by Representative Maddox and Jack. Are there objections to those amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Hill?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2357 as amended to the fourth and due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved House Bill 2357. To the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator
Brennan? Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brensky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Is Heidi back? Come on up. Yes. Sorry. Sometimes people come in here and we. House Bill 2383.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Reichen.
Katie Reichen, State Representative, District 4 from Newport. House Bill 3483 was submitted by myself on behalf of a constituent who's become landlocked in recent years. Approximately 30 years ago, she and her family bought a piece of land in Florence, planning to retire there, build a home there, and as I say, in recent years, a gentleman has come in, bought the surrounding property, and has refused to let her cross the road, cross his property, to get any utility service at all in there. House Bill 3483 is a bill that will make a simple change in the Oregon statutes to allow the provision of utility services to any person that has demonstrated need but currently does not have utilities available. This law will help to eliminate situations where citizens are unable to legally develop their property for habitation. This bill has gone through the House Environment and Energy Committee. There was no opposition, passed out unanimously, also passed out of the House unanimously. It's a fairly short and simple bill, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Ross, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I'm simply here to tell you that our association has reviewed the bill and is very supportive of it, believing it to be fair and reasonable and logical for all property owners involved, that It does not add further encroachments to property because it assumes that a access easement already runs across subject property, and we believe that a right-of-way easement doesn't really mean anything unless there's the opportunity for utility service, because it, no development would be possible without that. The way of necessity statutes directs that compensation be paid not only to affected property owners, but also to the county for costs of administering the procedure, so we'd urge your support.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
Did I hear you say that this would only operate, you'd get a way of necessity for utility services only if there were a right-of-way access? I don't see that in the bill.
Oh, perhaps I misstated that, that, no, it's not there. I'm sorry, I misstated that.
Okay.
Are there other questions?
No, I just wanted to clear that up, because I didn't see it.
Right, yes, would you make sure
it doesn't bother me.
It says what it does say. Why don't you introduce yourself for the record, and...
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm Representative Riken's legislative assistant. Mrs. Labrador, she did want me to...
Okay, we've had people who requested to take up the two, at least two major folks who are here on the seatbelt bill, and then we have three other bills which belong to Jack, and have a lot of people signed up. This committee is scheduled to go till, there's Representative Corey. Come on up. Well, let me visit a little bit for the audience. Yes, we've been accommodating legislators most of the time. House Bill, we'll take the, at least some of the parties who have to leave on House Bill 2588 before we get into the stop bill and the other, but, and we've alerted the folks in the audience who were interested in that, and then we'll move into those two bills as soon as we finish. So we are now at 2518, a work session on the computer crime bill.
There are amendments, Madam Chair, and I'll hand those out. You should have in your file from the hearing the dash four amendments offered by Representative Kaluri. I will pass out the dash five, which is an additional amendment by from U.S. West and Representative Kaluri.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and address yourself to that? I know that Senator Shoemaker's had concerns along the way as well.
Yeah.
So.
Just to, first of all, I'm State Representative Ted Kaluri. I have with me Gary Wilhelms from U.S. West and Jay Frazier, a counsel with U.S. West. The issues that were brought up, and astutely so, I might say, by this committee last time, related to a number of things. One of them had to do with asking us, Senator Hill asked us to check on those other states that I talked about that we used as a model and see whether or not they use the similar type scheme in having some crimes as felonies and some not. And we checked and found that they have precisely the same kind of a scheme in the breakdown that we have in this bill with the parts under sections 2 and 3 being felonies and part under 4 being misdemeanor, and that is follows the model that these other states follow. Another question that was asked by Senator Shoemaker had to do with what's the word I'm trying to
definition of proprietary.
Proprietary information. And we have an amendment to submit to you, which is dash A5, Senator Shoemaker and others. What you might want to look at, and perhaps it would be appropriate to have Ms. Frazier talk about where that came from.
Thank you. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Jay Frazier. I'm an attorney with U.S. West Communications. The amendment that we have put before you is taken from ORS 192.501 sub 2, which is a definition of trade secrets, which is found in the public records law.
192.501
sub 2. The language has been slightly tweaked by legislative council. What we've done is tried to address Senator Shoemaker's concern that the definition of proprietary information includes any commercial information, whether it is actually special information or information that is readily available.
Mr. Wild.
Senator Hill.
How many states have such legislation?
I could respond.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Gary Wilhelms with U.S. West Communications, Senator Hill. I can't tell you how many for sure, but I did call and check this morning with our staff in Denver who has been monitoring such legislation around the country. And I stopped him after he listed California, West Virginia, Massachusetts, Maine, Minnesota, and Oklahoma as people who had bills in this session of the legislature. And Minnesota, which happens to be one of the U.S. West states, did pass their legislation, and it is relatively similar to the legislation we have in Oregon. Arizona has a law that follows the same principles. It's not exactly the same, but evidently in Arizona they have about five different classes of felonies. And so depending upon the value or the amount of the value involved in each case. But they have a law on the books that's very similar. California's theft of service law also applies to data. It's a theft of services of telecommunications service, but it has been determined that that law also now applies to data. So they have a law in place. State of Iowa does, and the state of Wyoming does, and those states that we are directly involved with. Now, there may be more, but I don't have that information. I thought it was kind of overload, frankly.
Senator Hill, if I could just join in, the article that I referred to was out of the NCSL magazine, which I might say that article was September of 1984, listed off, and I'd be glad to make you a copy of this, but listed off the states alphabetically and says in here that they have enacted computer abuse legislation in recent years, and I counted 30 of them. And it's
in various forms, so let's
absolutely various forms. That's true, except that what we found is that Arizona is often referred to as the model. And as I mentioned to you, when I gathered up in with regard to the subject of definition of data, it was very evident that they started with the Arizona, and then every state added a word or two.
Okay, great, thanks.
Madam Chair, yes. As I looked at the amendment, I noted that it says that is known to limited individuals within an organization, and I thought, well, that doesn't really confine it very much because ordinary commercial information would be known to limited individuals.
Well, I think that in that's absolutely limited individuals. Well, our concern, Senator Shoemaker, is we have a very large database that contains, for instance, non-published listings. And if that information were obtained by a computer hacker, it's very serious, not only for our company, but also for the individuals who have requested that their information regarding their listings, address and phone number, be kept confidential and private. That information is available to probably a large number of people within our company, but they are limited within our company. And our concern was if we left the language only to certain individuals, that we would not be protecting that database.
And then, so the information you're talking about is not known only to people within your company, it is also known to other people.
No, but I'm sorry. I'm talking about non-published listings. So if you were to call a telephone company and say, I don't want to be listed in the phone book, okay, that goes into our database. We know what your address is for billing purposes, but it's not available on a general basis. We consider that to be protected information.
You consider that to be proprietary?
Absolutely.
Owned by you?
Would list would be owned by them, wouldn't it?
The list is, the lists are owned by U.S. West.
So that's why you're not willing to go with the language that's in the trade secrets definition, which is known only to certain individuals.
To certain individuals. Our concern was over the language of certain individuals.
Could be any.
Well, does the word only bother you? How about known only to limited individuals? Does that give you a problem?
No, that doesn't give me heartburn.
Okay.
My concern, frankly, is that only to certain individuals is very, very narrow. And we have a need to keep it a little broader.
Okay, so if we were to change it then to read, that is known only to limited individuals within an organization, you'd be comfortable?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would move to amend the amendment in that respect.
Senator Schumacher has, actually we need to move the A5 amendments. Would you?
Yeah, I'll move the A5 amendments, adding the word only after the word known in line 2.
Objections to that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Now, we have, Jack, you have any other comments?
No, except we have the dash 4 amendments that Representative Florida passed out last
right.
time, which define, further define that and maybe a couple of other.
Okay. Changes. And the chair would move the 2518-4 amendments. And, I don't understand. We just changed it. I don't understand what you're doing here. Because we're amending the data. The
dash 5 amendments amend proprietary information.
Yeah.
And they don't amend the definition of
no,
data?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, not.
That's right.
Data is G, proprietary information is I. The
right.
Amendment 5 adds to already what you have in the definition of proprietary.
Okay.
Two different subsections.
So the chair has moved the A4 amendments.
Whose amendments?
Those are Corey's amendments.
Corey's amendments.
I have a note here that says line really 8, 9, and 10, the last sentence there, lines 9 and 10 are in fact the local addition to some more broader language that you've lifted
That's right.
from other places.
That's right.
Are there objections to Chair's amendments to adopting the A4 amendments? Hearing none, so on. Anything else?
I'll move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Schumacher is moving House Bill 2518 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please, Pat.
Aye.
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 Hill?
Aye.
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have we have people who have to leave on House Bill 2588, and is Charlie Williamson here?
Yes.
Okay, Charlie, why don't you come on up? And then after Charlie, I hear from Sandy, and then I want to take some John Tung from Lake Oswego and a couple of public members he's brought along.
Madam Chair, Charles Williamson with the Oregon Tribal Association. I do have some written testimony I've just submitted. House Bill 2588 reverses partially an Oregon Supreme Court decision from December 1987 that suddenly allowed what we call a seatbelt defense to be introduced in personal injury jury trials in Oregon. Prior to that time, for a long period, evidence of non-use of seatbelts was not permitted in Oregon in that it was deemed that a person is not bound to anticipate the negligence of another person. So if you were not negligent and not causing the accident, not the cause of the the accident, you were not precluded from recovering all or any portion of your damages if you're not wearing a seatbelt. The imposition of the seatbelt offenses caused significant hardship on Oregonians, especially since a majority of them don't wear seatbelts and haven't been induced to wear seatbelts in the year and a half since this new defense was enacted by the court. I have submitted some testimony of Julianne Smith, which was given to the House, about how she and her family were hit by a driver who turned left in front of them and came across the road. They tried to avoid him hit him. They suffered some serious injuries. I won't read the testimony to you word for word. They have, Mrs. Smith does indicate that she had about $9,000 in medical bills for these injuries, which she's been unable to pay as the family did not have medical insurance. And they were totally precluded from recovering anything from this other driver or his insurance company as a result of this accident. They were not at fault in the accident, but they didn't have their seatbelts on. This is the sort of thing that's happening to people in approximately, to some degree or another, in approximately 60% of the cases in the state. The seatbelt defense causes cases to go much longer without settling because insurers have a possibility of defenses. So now they'll drag out a case and settle it on the verge of trial when they previously would have paid the policy limits a year or so before. With regard to the history of, not so much history, but the recent history of the seatbelt defenses, this is something which was fostered by the federal government mandating airbags and passive restraints in automobiles. 33% states with two-thirds of all drivers were supposed to enact mandatory seatbelt laws allowing to some degree or another a seatbelt defense in order to, for automobile companies to not have to install airbags or other passive restraints. So a lot of funding for lobbying efforts and so forth was put into to this. They did get 33 states, but there was nowhere near two-thirds of the drivers in the country with this provision. So beginning this year, passive restraints are going to have to be built into all new cars starting in September. And so between now and the time the fleet essentially is replaced, there needs to be some protection for people who are going to be victimized by the seatbelt defense. We tried to get this bill by the House to reinstate the old rule in Oregon. We were not successful. We compromised so that evidence of non-use of the seatbelt is permitted in court. The jury does learn about it. We're not keeping any secrets. But the bill provides that a person who didn't wear their seatbelt cannot have their recovery decimated as a result of this defense. They can't lose more than 5% of the damage they would have otherwise received as a result of that. The jury would be instructed as to that, and they could make that deduction themselves. This should help to keep down the amount of court and trial time dedicated to the seatbelt defense, where experts on both sides come in and say, and essentially speculate to the jury as to what would have happened if a person had worn a seatbelt. You have cases where a person's thrown from the vehicle, they suffer some injuries. If they'd stayed in the vehicle, they may have suffered completely different injuries. Should they be entitled to recover for the injuries they would have sustained if they'd worn a seatbelt? Should they be entitled to recover for the injuries they did sustain but reduced by some amount, but even though none of those injuries would have been incurred if they'd worn a seatbelt? It makes jury trials and battles of experts, expensive battles of experts, largely a joke with speculating over what the effect of the seatbelt is. This simply says you still can collect, you can pay your medical bills, you can get your last wages, you can get your damages, but you're going to suffer a little bit because you didn't wear a seatbelt. And it will make it so it won't be economically feasible to go to war over the seatbelt defense. Not everybody's going to bring in experts to fight over 5%. I think most cases, if it really wouldn't matter, the plaintiff will probably just give up the 5%. If it wouldn't have mattered, the defendant probably will give it up. As I said, only the statistics presented to the House by Oregon Traffic Safety now indicated there's not any significantly greater amount of people wearing seatbelts now than there were when this decision came down. So essentially, you have the only thing that this seatbelt defense does now is it enriches insurance companies at the expense of injured Oregonians, and it, generally, it's the Oregonians who are less sophisticated, less knowledgeable and educated, and probably less well-to-do. It decreases the amount of money available for medical care from auto insurance sources. It denies injured people recovery because they did not do, because they didn't do something they didn't know was negligence. You've got a majority of people out there not doing it. You've got a majority, something like 57%, voting it down in the last election. It causes, as in the Smith case, hospitals and doctors not to be paid, and we believe it helps to raise health insurance costs. It does all those things without getting people to wear seatbelts. I won't go into, I do have a chronological history of the seatbelt defense and seatbelt use in Oregon statutes, but I won't go over that. It is there for your information, the vote. And a brief summary, this 5% solution, I guess I should say, was adopted originally in Missouri, actually, it's a 1%. Michigan and Iowa have adopted it at 5%. Nebraska had a 5% rule. They repealed it in favor of our old rule of no percent. And Louisiana had a 2%, which they repealed in favor of our old rule of a no percent. Eight states... Well, it's over half the states don't have the seatbelt defense. Of the ones that do, I don't have the exact figures, but a substantial amount of them have mandatory seatbelt laws. If you have a mandatory seatbelt law, and everybody knows you've got to wear a seatbelt by law, the seatbelt defense tends to make more sense than it does in Oregon, where you don't have that. I'd be glad to answer any questions or try.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Sandy Flicker. And I guess I'd ask you, Sandy, if you could be brief. We can probably get you back another time during work session if you...
Thank you. I appreciate the consideration. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I'm here today representing Oregon Traffic Safety Now, which is a safety belt coalition in the state of Oregon. We are opposed to House Bill 2588 in its original version and in the amended version that came to you from the House. I will briefly make some comments about safety belts because I do believe that safety belts is the issue here. I would disagree with your former witness in saying that there is no speculation about the relationship between injuries and seatbelt use. There has been millions and millions and millions of dollars that have been done to provide for studies by both federal government and private organizations to determine the relationship between injuries and death and the use of safety belts. A couple of things I'd like to quote to you. In a study of 1,364 accident victims at four hospitals in the Chicago area, the researchers found that seatbelts reduced the severity of injury by 60.1%, hospital admissions by 64.6%, and hospital charges by 66.3%. That was done by the University of Illinois. I'm going to bring it a little closer to home now by giving you some information from a special study from the Oregon State Health Division Injury Registry in 1985. In other words, one of the conclusions was of all drivers injured in any given period, belted drivers in motor vehicle accidents may be more likely to experience no injury or milder injuries which do not require an overnight hospital stay and therefore would not be reported to the injury registry. One of the summary and conclusions was the data available for this study of 376 Oregon drivers clearly indicate that unbelted drivers of cars involved in crashes are at significantly increased risk of severe injury or death when compared to belted drivers. There is no speculation about this issue, believe me. It has very simply been proven that safety belts do reduce injuries by approximately 60%. All the time and money that is spent on these studies that have determined beyond a reasonable doubt that you subject yourself to increased injuries when you do not wear a seatbelt, how can we then say that it is not relevant information for a jury in a motor vehicle case? Just as all other information in an auto accident is important for the jury to have made available to them, so is seatbelt use. Putting an arbitrary 5% cap on mitigation of damages basically is saying that all accidents are the same, and nothing could be farther from the truth. Every single motor vehicle accident has different circumstances involved, and all of those circumstances should be available for a jury to decide. If I hit someone going 20 miles an hour, rear-end them, which is very likely it happens every day, and that person hits the windshield and sustains a life-threatening or a completely debilitating head injury, which changes the rest of their life, when if they'd had a seatbelt on, they may have gotten a bruise on their shoulder blade, I don't want to have to pay for that person for the rest of my life either. There are many different circumstances involved.
What's your organization?
It's Oregon Traffic Safety Now. It's a Safety Belt Coalition. We promote safety belt use.
What is the purpose of your organization?
To promote safety belt use. Our goal is to get 70% use rates in Oregon by 1990. Right now we have right around 50% belt use. Well, and to pass a mandatory safety belt use law.
I understand that you want people to use their safety belts.
Absolutely.
I think the thing that bothers me, though, is that now once, though, that all of that has been done and we had it up for a vote of the people, some of us voted for the safety belt legislation, and I guess the thing that bothers me about, if you want to encourage people to use their safety belts, fine, but when you start talking about people who are injured, given for whatever reason, that's the thing that becomes a little bothersome to me. I mean, it's almost, we tried to pass a law to force people to do it. It went out for a vote. They voted it down. The people of this state have some right to say something. And then to come in and say now that even though we don't have a law, and then once that aside, and now you're talking about injuries where people are seriously injured, and it seems to me that the issue then sort of shifts away from safety belt use as to what's going to happen when people are injured. And I guess I'm just a little troubled that you want them to use safety belts with kind of a vengeance. Well, in the sense that if they get hurt very badly, you want them to, I guess, to really suffer, perhaps more than they are suffering, and say that is going to take it into account. I mean, we tried to force people to do it as much as we could. The Senate was no referral to the people of this thing when it came out of here. We voted straight up for a mandatory seatbelt legislation. And it just seems now that we have a situation where we don't have a law, and then to come in and say, well, one way, is this kind of a backhanded way then to get people to use their seatbelts? Because, see, I don't understand how you get into the liability issue. If your issue is safety belts, you push it and push it. But now you seem to have gone beyond the purview of your charge, as you describe it, or the purpose of your organization.
Senator Hill, Madam Chair, I don't believe that you can put boundaries on the issue. If you believe that people should wear safety belts to reduce the risk of injury to themselves, that's what we sell as personal responsibility. And personal responsibility has to have some consequences, too, when there is no personal responsibility. And we don't put a boundary or a cap on our efforts of getting people to wear safety belts. We believe that people should wear safety belts. We believe the information, the previous witness indicated that Oregonians maybe aren't smart enough to know that. I disagree entirely. That information has been made available for 20 years since seatbelts have been in cars.
Okay, but we're not going to argue the advisability of wearing seatbelts right now. I simply wanted to. Most of us are convinced of that, as Senator Hill said. The Senate voted to do it straight out. So,
I don't believe that the ballot. There is not a law in this state that requires you to wear bicycle helmets and other things, and that is not barred from the courtroom. So I don't believe that you can look at this particular issue and say that it's any different than anything else.
If I have a bicycle accident and I'm not wearing a helmet, then I can be deprived of.
It's my understanding that's admissible as evidence. We're dealing with the admissibility issue.
Okay, well.
And our position is that it's relevant information to be admitted for the jury to decide, and that's the appropriate place for it to be.
Well, I guess, thank you. I guess my question is, why is that? Do you take that position because you feel it's going to encourage people to use their seatbelts?
That we aren't here today because we introduced this legislation, or no. We would never have gotten involved with this legislation had it not been proposed in this session, and we believe that as an organization we have a responsibility to come and talk to you about the issue.
I know, but what you're saying is something that is very serious, and that you're saying
absolutely
is that people who get hurt
even though they paid their insurance, and there's no law that requires them to have us, to wear a seatbelt, that they should somehow be deprived of the fact, deprived of what they have paid for. And I'm saying is that I want to know why it is that you're taking, is your purpose in supporting this legislation to encourage people to wear or use their seatbelts? Or is it just to...
Our purpose in supporting this legislation is to, yes, make a statement that seatbelts do reduce injury and therefore should be worn, and that a jury should decide. It should not be barred from the jury. All evidence, all facts should be admitted into the courtroom for the jury to decide, based on fact, how much that person contributed to their own damages. That's not a decision. Putting a 5% cap is nothing, you know, I can't do that. I don't know any of the information that's available in each case.
So your premise is that most people know the consequences of not wearing seatbelts.
I believe that.
And so then they know that they should wear them, and because they're not wearing them, then we want to, what do we want to do? Punish them?
We're not into punishment. We're not into being vindictive at all. We want there to be consequences to everybody's actions. That's what we want, personal responsibility. If there are no consequences, then nobody should ever have to reduce their risk. I think we all have a personal responsibility to reduce our risk, and if we do, then there has to be a consequence to that. And we're not doing this, you know, it's not an anti-victim thing at all. We have a, you know, that's not the position of our organization at all.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Gretzky.
As a practical matter, have you ever seen how one of these things plays out in a trial?
No, I have not, Senator, and I'm not an attorney, so I can't speak to anything legal.
I appreciate that, but you come in with a bunch of statistics about the use of seatbelts, but that really isn't the issue. What the issue here is a party that comes into court who's been injured. That party, that's what this deals with. This isn't a nationwide study. This isn't whether or not people should wear seatbelts. It's when a person's injured and they're in court trying to receive compensation for their injuries.